Good morning. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs, Connecticut. I am Pedlin Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's March 15th, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, please call or text 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook, and you can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, or you can also listen to us on iTunes. Wow, we're everywhere. Anyway, please, if you feel like you have any comments or you need to reach us in any way, bicycletalk1@gmail.com is very easy for me to see because I have it right here on the screen in front of me. So moving on, Ron's rant of the week. Okay, I'm going to rant on Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah, okay. Why am I ranting on poor Atlanta? I mean, Atlanta is a nice town. It's a nice city, right? I'm sure a number of people have been there. Well, there's this issue going on down there, and there appears to be a bunch of people that are getting increasingly vocal about bicycles on their roads, because Atlanta is a city which is growing rapidly, and as it grows, it gets busier and busier. There are more and more people on bicycles. Atlanta's a great place to ride a bike because it's warm down there, more so than other parts of the country, and for more of the years. And there's just a whole bunch of people that are ranting on Atlanta. And bicycles being there and telling people that, bicycles should not be on the road, and that, this is for cars and not for you. And it's just there's a thing going on down there right now. And there is also an Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, which is, fighting for they're fighting for the cyclists' rights down there, which is very, very nice. But it's just there's just some things going on in Atlanta that there are some angry people, and this anger seems to be growing. So this is a problem. People who drive cars, there's just people that have just said really bad things. Nobody cycles to and from work regularly on Peachtree, which is a busy road, so we won't reduce the number of cars on the road. We will have the same number, but they will move slower and extend rush hours considerably. This is what the naysayers are saying. They just don't understand it. Atlanta is not a bikeable city. It's hilly and hot, and the rain is torrential. The two cyclists you see in an average week on Peachtree are back in their cars in the summers. And they're trying to put bike lanes on avenues that are generally flat and easy to ride on. And this is what's going on. But there is a coalition called the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, which is fighting back and trying to do positive things for cycling. So we're going to leave Atlanta alone for now. But I just wanted to rant on the anti-bike lane Atlantans this week. I have a guest on this week, which is really exciting because we love to have guests. Our guest will be on the phone with us, and he has called in. And our guest today is Tyler Wren. And Tyler Wren is from, oh gosh, you're way the heck up there in Burlington, Vermont. Tyler, can you hear me?
I'm here, Ron. Thanks.
Hey, there you are. All right. Great. The technology worked. We always love it when it works here. So anyway, Tyler, hey, did you get any snow out of that last little storm that we just had?
I'd say we have almost 3 feet. Not a lot of cycling to be had here in Burlington today.
Oh, 3 feet. Wow. We didn't get 3 feet. We definitely got a lot less. And we also got the lovely freezing rain sleet on top of the snow afterwards. But wow, 3 feet, that's a lot of snow. So I do you ski?
I do ski sometimes, cross-country skate skiing and snowshoeing. Great cross training for cycling, and I gotta say, I do a lot of snow shoveling too. It's a good core workout up here in the wintertime.
I got in 4 hours yesterday with a heart rate monitor on. Yeah, it was good.
Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's solid, solid work. It really is. So anyway, I'm just going to reflect here just really quickly on how Tyler and I met. And that is Tyler has a business that is basically promotes bicycle tours. And it is a farm to fork fondo that he puts on. And we'll talk about this later in the show. But that's how we originally met at one of these events. I'm going to move forward here, and I want to ask you the famous question that we ask everyone, and I want you to relate to me your first remembered experience on a bicycle.
That's a good question. I grew up in Philadelphia, in the city, and I lived there till I was about six, and I remember having a bicycle in the city, or maybe just getting a bike, and my whole world was my one block in the city. And when I got a bike, I could ride to my friend's house 3 blocks away. I could ride to my other friend's house 10 blocks away. It just sort of expanded my world, changed my whole life back then. And I have a great photo of me riding that bike. It was a BMX bike, I think, sort of like standing up on the saddle, being a daredevil, showing extreme bike handling skills back then.
Oh boy.
Strong affinity for the bike. So it's always been a big part of my life. And so I do remember those days, 4, 5, 6 years old in Philadelphia, riding my bike around town, raising hell.
That's great. That's wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. You know, and you've done really well with cycling. And you know, it looks, you sent me obviously over some bullet points here, but in the world of cyclists, of people who are into this whole bicycle thing, you're somewhat famous. So could you tell us a little bit about, you know, where you went with your cycling and, you know, how you got into it?
Sure. I wouldn't say I'm famous, but I had I was a professional cyclist for 13 years.
That's more than a lot of us can say.
Sure. So you know, I think it's just a testament to the fact that I'm passionate about cycling. You know, cycling as a career for most everyone is in it, whether they're a professional cyclist, whether they're organizing events, whether they're working at a bike shop, working in the industry. The common theme is that we could probably all be getting paid more somewhere else, and we're doing it because we're passionate about it. So as a professional cyclist, you know, I went to a good college, and I graduated. My friends were getting jobs as investment bankers, making six figures, and I took a contract for a pro cycling team making $5,000 a year and living in my mom's basement, and I thought they were all fools.
My goodness.
I just pursued it with all my heart and made a career out of it, and I really got to travel the world and pursue my passion. You know, I wouldn't change it for the world.
You probably got to do a lot of things that you went to Princeton. Is that right?
That's right.
Princeton.
Yeah, Princeton. There you go, Fran. Fran grew up right outside of Princeton.
I grew up in East Windsor.
Yeah.
Hightstown. I went to Hightstown High. Do you remember that?
I know it's great cycling in that part of
it
New Jersey.
It is. So. There's a lot of, if you can get away from like the Route 1 corridor and you go, there's wonderful country roads. They have these amazing networks of the county roads there. And that part of New Jersey is relatively flat. Now, if you get a little bit north of Princeton, not so flat. Once you get into Rocky Hill and, Griggstown and Skillman, and then you have the Sourlands in New Jersey, and Sourlands in New Jersey are just like around here. And then you get into northwestern New Jersey and forget about it. You're in the mountains.
If you haven't figured it out yet, Fran's a Jersey girl.
Yeah. I grew up half an hour from Princeton, and I went to Rutgers.
So
that's where I fell in love with cycling, Fran. So yeah. You know, with road cycling. So I feel you.
Yeah. So when you were at Princeton, you were on the cycling team there?
That's right. Yeah, I was a runner in high school, and I was hoping to be a cross-country and track runner at Princeton, but I had some shin and knee problems, and I got a bike to stay in shape, and pretty soon after getting a road bike, I realized that was the sport for me, and they had a great club team at Princeton, and there was a whole collegiate circuit where we'd be racing on the East Coast all spring, and there's a national championships every year. So it's a great environment to get started cycling.
So how did you do in that, with that experience? Did you do well with it?
Yeah, I did. You know, by my my sophomore year, I started my freshman year, and then by my sophomore year, I won a national championship on the road.
Oh, my goodness.
Quick success. Yeah.
Yeah, that I would say that's very successful.
I did have some background as a mountain biking in high school, too, so I wasn't completely new to riding a bike, racing a bike. But
sure.
I was new to road cycling, and, you know, it was just, I put everything I had into that. You know, it was the Princeton cycling team motto was study to pass, ride to win. And I think I really lived up to that.
Also eat at PJ's Pancake House in Hoagie Haven?
That's right, yeah, yeah. Staples.
Was Marita's Cantina still there when you were there?
That rings a bell, but that wasn't one of my regular spots.
But Hoagie Haven and PJ's.
Haven. Yeah, oh yes. Everyone knows about those places.
And Thomas Sweets.
Yeah, there you go.
Right, that's the ice cream place, yeah.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Mm. So you were very successful with that. Now, you mentioned something about mountain biking, too. So I'm assuming being in Vermont and being – did you grow up in Burlington area?
No, I'm actually from Philadelphia.
Oh, you're from Philly. That's right. You said that earlier.
Yeah, so I moved to Burlington just a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So, that's new.
But you know, when I got started cycling, the mountain bike scene was really big in the late 90s.
Yes, it was.
So my father and I would – go do mountain bike races together. He'd do the beginner masters, then I'd do the junior experts, and he'd be racing against my rival's fathers, and it was a really fun scene back then.
You know, it was a great scene back then. I remember taking a friend of mine who had moved out of the country for a little while, and when he moved back, at that time I owned a bicycle shop, and he said, "So what's going on? You know, what's the racing scene like?" I said, "Oh, it's all mountain bike now." And he goes, "What do you mean mountain bike?" So I took him to a big mountain bike race, and he just stood there with his mouth wide open because we both raced on the road, and he was watching this, and he said, "Wow, I can't believe this. This is incredible." And it was like there was obviously very serious people like yourself that were racing mountain bikes, but then there were also the partiers that kind of came along for the ride. They'd go out, they would race their mountain bike, quote unquote, and then they would, they would crack open, they would tailgate basically afterwards. And it was like this big festive thing. It was pretty cool. And though
I remember it well, yeah.
Yeah.
There were some pretty major races up and down the East Coast, and, so you could take it seriously. You could have a good time. All the categories were pretty filled up. So
yeah,
it's, feel nostalgic when I think about it.
Did you race at Mount Snow?
I did.
Yeah, yeah. There was some big time racing going on there. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wow, very cool, very cool. And you must have gone to the one. There was a big one up in Canada too. That was shortly after that. It was a World Cup race. I can't remember.
Didn't go to Canada, but I went down to the one they had a World Cup down in Conyers, Georgia, on the Olympic course a couple of years after the Olympics.
Nice.
So, some big races going on.
Yeah. So how many years did you race mountain bikes?
Just when I was in high school, so 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a few races after that, kind of sporadically. I did the collegiate mountain bike circuit as well.
Mm-hmm.
That would be in the fall when they had the mountain bike season, and the spring for the road bike season. I can't say enough good things about the collegiate cycling scene. It's just such a great place to learn how to ride your bike. We had skills clinics every weekend. You know, you're racing with people your own age and people who are just as passionate about cycling, from beginners in the category D to the real like elite category one riders in the A class. And it's just a great environment. And I think that really set me up for being passionate about road cycling.
That's great. Yeah, they have a good collegiate scene right here at the University of Connecticut, where we broadcast out of also. And, you know, I know that I was, when I had my store, I was actively involved with that because they didn't have a lot of funding or anything back then. So I would throw everybody in the back of my van and drive them off to the collegiate races. And it was just kind of a fun thing to do. But it's a building program, and it seems like it gets people like yourself involved and moving on. So you fell in love with skinny tires, though. You got you went to our side of the road. And what changed you over to that, other than, you know, being down in Princeton and on the cycling team? Was there anything else that kind of drew you into the skinny tire world?
Well, I remember watching the Tour de France 1999, I think it was Lance's first tour win. It was the year before I went to Princeton, and I was enthralled by that race, and that was the first time I really watched the tour and saw how big it was over there in Europe, and started to realize pretty quickly, okay, wow, you can have a career as a professional athlete, and maybe that's something I can do. And as soon as I started to have success on the road, that kind of became my focus. I said, okay, I don't want to be an investment banker like everyone else is trying to be here. I want to be a professional cyclist and use the tools I have around me to achieve that goal.
Wow. Wow. That's a hefty goal.
Yeah. I didn't, you know, it's the kind of thing where you don't really know the path, and there's no feeding system. It's not like you're getting calls from pro teams if you're doing well as a collegiate cyclist. You have to be trying to make relationships and promote yourself and ask other people how do they become a professional and ask them to make an introduction to their director. And so it's a tough world to navigate, but I just kept at it, and a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, and eventually got caught a break.
So you actually pursued this yourself. You actually went out and, you know, just made a lot of contacts, and then finally somebody said, yeah, we'll take you. Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think I've just found with a lot of things in life, when you're trying to just make your way, I mean, for me, it was useful to talk to other professionals who, like, you know, I'd see them at the race and I'd make a point to go up to them and say, hey, how did you become a pro, you know, and ask them their story. And typically they're going to answer you and tell you their path. And then I tried to emulate it. They said, well, I knew this guy and he gave me a shot and I took a contract for no money and had some success. And then I got more money the next year. And so I was fortunate enough to be in New Jersey, where Colavita USA is based. It's an Italian importer of olive oil. And they were starting a pro team in 2003, which was my senior year in college. So new pro team, they were looking for rising talent. They were in New Jersey, where I was going to school, and the owner of that team, this guy John Profaci, I just sent him a lot of emails and called him, and just sort of made it so he couldn't ignore me, and he relented and offered me a job.
Yeah,
and it worked out.
That's great. So I'm assuming that you finished college, right? You did actually finish up there. You didn't go like all pro and give up on the whole school thing, right?
That's right. I graduated in 2003, which was the first year I had a contract. And but actually that spring semester, my final semester, I was on the road. I raced Tour de Georgia, and I had my senior thesis due the Monday after Tour de Georgia.
Oh,
so I was working on it in my hotel room after doing these, you know, 100-mile stages with Cipollini and all these European pros, trying to get my schoolwork done, and I think I got like a B plus on that thesis. You know, I skated by.
I would say that's more than skate, but that's okay.
A B plus at Princeton? That's like an A plus anywhere else.
Yeah, I give you a major pat in the back for that one. Wow, you're racing with Mario Cipollini?
Yeah, I mean, more than just him. You know, we raced. I can't remember all the stars that came over to those races in the U.S. back then, you know.
Right.
Like Lance and Floyd and Contador and Ivan Basso and all the big stars, you know, would eventually come over to the races in the U.S. They love coming to the U.S. Big hotels, big beds, you know, shopping. It was like a vacation for those guys. So.
Oh, no kidding. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Well, just the fact that you're out there and you're riding in the same, you know, you're riding in the same peloton as they are, that would just, I don't know, I would probably lose it by just being there with them. But obviously you have a job to do and you're there and it's just another day, but there's, you know, it's just amazing that you can be with all these really cool, famous people. What a great experience. That's something they probably didn't teach you at Princeton.
Right. Well, you know, but I think they encouraged you to pursue your interests, even if they're outside the box. I mean, like, that's one thing that they, you know, claim to do, and I think they actually do. You know, if you're a crazy, talented oboe player, you know, they're going to support you and help you do that. If you want to be a pro cyclist, no one's going to tell you not to do it. So
also,
you know, go ahead.
Yeah, also, if you want to be a movie star or if you want to be FLOTUS, they encourage you to
there
do
you
that.
Go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So you're, tell us a little more about your racing days. You know, where you raced, experiences you may have had.
Sure. So that team, Cola Vida, it sort of morphed and had different title sponsors, and it grew, and eventually became one of the top domestic professional cycling teams. And I was with them for my whole 13-year career in their various iterations. And you know, in the early days, it was small. We were mostly racing on the East Coast. We didn't have any stars on the team, and then pretty soon we started picking up bigger riders, expanding our schedule. And in its heyday, you know, towards the 2010 and to 2014, we were traveling to races in South America. We raced in Asia. We raced in Europe. So we got to see the world and do some pretty major races and compete with the best riders in the world. You know, we competed with Chris Froome after he won his Tour de France, and Lance and Floyd and all these superstars. So it was a, you know, a great experience, and I got to learn Spanish from my Spanish-speaking teammates. That's a life skill I gained from my time with them and going down to South America. So, yeah, really rich experience. And the thing is, everyone you encounter, even the guys at the top, you know, they are passionate about what they're doing. And you just get so much energy from being in that peloton and, you know, racing down in South America with the Cuban national team and these guys who are, you know, don't have much opportunity at home, and they're putting everything they can into racing their bikes, and people from these different backgrounds like that. But the common thread is that we just share the passion for riding a bike.
It's an interesting world. I tell people about, you know, I never raced at the level that you race, but I raced up to like a Cat 2 here in the U.S. And I explain to people that there's a certain camaraderie about the bike racers. They all kind of, you know, we're all into the same thing. We understand it. We get it. And it's almost like people take care of one another. Did you ever feel that or experience that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, even in cutthroat races, you know, in a tough crosswind where, you know, the race is blown apart and everyone is very competitive, fighting for every wheel, they're still going to be calling out potholes, and, you know, it's still going to be, you know, making you aware of any hazards coming up in the road, just out of mutual respect, you know, that we're all, you know, it's a battlefield out there, but we're all, you know, yeah, we're all share the same passion. We all want to be safe. And so, yeah, I certainly feel that way.
That's really cool. Did you ever win anything in any of these races?
I did, yeah. You know, it's I didn't win a lot of races, but I was pretty consistent in my, you know, getting lots of podiums and top threes. But one of my biggest achievements was a race down in Chile, an international stage race called the Vuelta Chile, the Tour of Chile, and the queen stage of that 10-day stage race was a. It was a mountaintop finish outside of Santiago, Chile, in the Andes. It was a 40-kilometer climb to the finish.
Just
a crazy, something like 45 or 50 switchbacks on this climb. Just an insane climb.
Oh, my goodness. I can't imagine. That's never ending. You go around a corner, you look up, and you go around a corner, you look up, you go around a corner, you look up, right?
Yeah. And this race was in January, so the height of the summer down there, but us gringos were coming from winter time. So the plan for the day was for me to get into the breakaway and try to get a head start on that climb and see if I could win the stage from the break.
Right.
And the first part of the day went well. I got into the breakaway like we planned for. We hit the bottom of that 40-kilometer climb with about a 6-minute advantage. And I attacked the breakaway group, and I was solo going up the climb, and it was a really surreal experience because it's a really big event down there. It's like their biggest cycling race. It's their national tour, so there's fans everywhere. There's a ESPN helicopter flying above. There's television cameras in the cars ahead of me. So, and it's just me for like a full hour and a half.
Do you have great flashbacks? It must be tremendous.
I do, yeah. It was like goosebumps because these guys are, and the fans are so enthusiastic. They're cheering, you know, "Vamos, gringo!" Like, go, gringo is a, you know, term for Americans. "Vamos, blanco!" Go, white guy.
How funny. Now, the fans, you know, we watch this on TV. You know, we'll see, like, the Tour de France or the Giro or the Vuelta a España, and you watch it on TV, and you see that the fans are, like, they crowd you into the road. Were they doing that there?
They were, yeah. The most I've ever experienced that is at Tour of California, where on some of those races were just so packed with fans and people giving you pushes. If you're in the gruppetto, it's not uncommon to get a push up a climb from people in the crowd, which is much appreciated.
Sure. Explain gruppetto.
Gruppetto is in a stage race, typically on a hilly day. You know, there's going to be separation where the leaders and the people who are having a good day are fighting it out at the front, and then there's going to be a big group of people, the sprinters and people who can't compete with the climbers in the back, who kind of group together knowing that they have to make the time cut for that day. Every day you have to finish within a certain time in order to progress to the next stage. So a big group at the back form called the gruppetto to make it to the next day.
That's great.
Another example of camaraderie in the peloton.
Yeah, and you're getting it from the fans too. You're actually getting it from the fans because they're helping give you a little shove up the hill to get you up there.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm sure the officials are not paying any attention to that sort of behavior, so they probably look the other way, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No one's going to care if someone 25 minutes down gets a little push on a hill. So.
I just can't imagine, you know, climbing like when you won that stage. Obviously, there's no one new with you, and people just must be in your face screaming at you as you're running and running alongside of you as you're going up this hill, right?
Yeah, and it gives you a lot of energy when you have fans like that. And that stage, I actually didn't win that stage on the day. The person wearing the leader's jersey passed me with about 3 kilometers to go, and he held off everyone else, so I finished second on the day. But he later tested positive for EPO, and
oops.
I inherited the win. So he lost, he lost the entire race and that stage. But I kind of even before that happened, that day was really special for me because it was such an example of teamwork, getting into that breakaway, executing a plan, preparation, all the training I'd put into it, and concentration on that climb. I just felt like I laid everything out there, and it was the perfect day for me, and I felt so much satisfaction, even though that guy finished ahead of me on the day. And then inheriting it later was even more satisfaction. So
that's great.
That's one day I remember.
That's great. You know, I take things like this and I put them in a category, and they're called rocking chair stories, because you're going to have this for your whole life. And then, you know, you can say, well, back in the day.
I think I'm already saying that.
Yeah, you know what? Fine. That's fine, as you should. So here we go. You got a bunch of gringos. They're coming down from the North States. It's winter up here. You're going down there. What do you do to condition yourself to be able to go out and ride in a stage race in South America?
Well, you know, some guys would do crazy preparation things like riding their trainer in a sauna and things like this to get ready for the hot weather. But I always liked the heat, so I just made sure I hydrated well and had a lot of electrolytes, and I just went for it. So it wasn't a big deal to me.
You must have had some legs on you when you got there too, right?
Well, you know, a lot of times when I went to those races in South America, a lot of my preparation was snowshoeing and cross-country skiing and not a lot of bike time. But it just goes to show you that those are good preparation for cycling to do those endurance activities.
Well, that's the old Greg LeMond method. He was a big cross-country skier in the wintertime, and he would do all this really long-distance cross-country skiing, and he claimed that it was the way that he kept himself very fit. So,
yeah, I think it also, the change of pace is good for your head, too. You know, as you're not getting burned out on pedaling by the time you get to August.
Right. And you know, that is a definite factor, right? The burnout factor?
I think so. You know, as professional cycling, you know, sometimes you're racing 70, 80, 100 days a year.
Oh, my God.
So it can get to be a lot. So, yeah, anything you can do to stay mentally fresh and focused is going to help.
Wow. So you're talking about racing that much. Obviously, there's training involved in there, too. There's a few down days, whatever. But do you have like an estimate of how many miles that would be in a year?
You know, I used to know that off the top of my head, I can't remember. But I know it's like more miles than I would put on my car. You know, in the order of 15,000 plus miles, I think.
Wow.
If I can remember correctly.
Wow. It's amazing. And you don't even have to change the oil.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. So you had some success here in the U.S. also?
I did, yeah. I won the King of the Mountain title at the U.S. Professional Championships. I did that two times, actually. That was a nice feather in my cap. And I won a few national calendar events and had a few strong results. I was top 10 in the Tour of Georgia one year, which was a major international stage race. So... it was a career of consistency. I was always strong in hilly stage races, but as a U.S. cyclist, you have to be versatile too. So I tried to be strong in criteriums and shorter stage races too. And I just love getting my bike, no matter what kind of race it was.
That's great. That's great. Cool. So you left the pro race circuit. And what year did you do that?
2014 was my last year racing professional.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so where do you go from there? I mean that's one of those things where, I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but you know, you've had such a great experience. You know, you get done with all that and go, okay, I can die now. So, not that you will or that you did, but you had more experience on your bicycle than most people will have on mm-hmm. a bicycle, or most people will have that even went to Princeton. So what do you do from there?
Well, let me tell you what happened. There was one day that I was on my bike it must have been 2013 or early 2014. It was a beautiful, sunny day. I was out on a 5 or 6 hour training ride, 3 hours in on this beautiful road with no cars, by myself, and I'm like thinking like, wow, this is like the quintessential pinnacle of my existence right now. You know, the perfect training day, optimal conditions, I'm feeling strong. And I was all by myself, and I was like, you know, I'm not sharing this with anyone. And I feel like, you know, my whole career, you know, even though I interact with the fans and my teammates, like I feel like I can do something more broad. You know, I just feel like it was a day that motivated me to share my passion for cycling with a broader audience. So I sort of from that day started ruminating about how I could do that. And then I eventually decided to organize these inclusive events. I've built that into this Farm to Fort Fondo series that you mentioned. I'm just as passionate now about inspiring people to get on bikes and give them a great experience on the bike as I was about making myself a strong professional cyclist.
Well, I certainly know that because, again, like we met with at one of your Farm to Fork Fondos, which are just like really cool events, by the way. Very well done. Extremely well organized, lots of great food. You guys are like all about the food, and it's just a neat thing. And you bring in people like myself and, people who are passionate for cycling and want to ride their bikes in different areas and have different experiences with it. And you bring them all together, and it's a big, big 2 day weekend riding party or whatever you want to call it. Actually, it's just a 1 day event, actually, right? But there's 2 days because of your big feed the night before and all that. So you put on a great event. Tell me more about this Farm to Fork Fondo, because Fran and I really enjoyed being there.
Yeah, well, thanks for the compliment, and thanks for being there. You know, the idea kind of started from just thinking about how to make those inclusive events, and I thought, well, it has to be a compelling idea, and it has to be something that's going to get lots of different people excited, from my pro cycling buddies to people like you guys and to the local communities who are hosting the event. So, living here in Vermont and seeing – you know, the farms getting developed and riding routes being impacted when a beautiful farm gets developed into a housing development, I sort of had this idea in my head, well, there's this connection between farms, open space, riding your bike, and this local food movement going on. And I said, how can I tie all these things together? And how can I make an event that gets everyone excited about being involved and bring in different worlds, local community groups, farmers, pro cyclists, everyday athletes, local foodie organizations. And so that was kind of the genesis of the idea for this Farm to Fork Fondo. And the main goal is to get people on bikes and giving them this agenda of a social good of helping preserve farmlands and giving them a reason to preserve farmlands. It's sort of the...
Tyler, go back to where you were standing before. We're losing your signal.
Oh,
yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes. You're better now. Way better now. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. You sounded like you were in a submarine, and I know you're not. So,
okay.
No big deal. So, you put these events together. Let's see, where can we go from here? I mean, it appears that a lot of your events are focused around some fairly like organic farming and that sort of thing. Is that correct?
I really don't want to get too specific about what kind of farms we're supporting, because the main idea is there's all these beautiful landscapes that we ride our bikes by. You know, people, and wherever they live, they always have favorite riding routes, and I bet a lot of those favorite riding routes go past beautiful farmland.
Oh, yeah.
If they're here in the Northeast or really throughout the country. And I want to put a face to all the families, every beautiful barn, every beautiful pasture. You know, there's a farm family there working hard and maintaining that beautiful landscape. So I'm trying to put a face to that, whether it's organic or not. It doesn't really matter if they're farming and producing food that makes us, faster cyclists and also maintain that beautiful landscape. I want to put those two worlds together and give the cycling community a reason to support the farming community. So we have all different types of farmers. We have younger farmers doing all that organic farming with the newer ideas, and then we have old school dairy farmers and beef cattle farmers and kind of everything in between.
That's great. Now, you do a, if I remember correctly, you do a big feed the night before, too. You have kind of a fancy dinner that's related with this. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So it's called the, this year actually, it's called the Meet the Farmers Dinner. So we invite some of the farm families, the participating farm families who are hosting an aid station at the ride on Sunday. They're going to be at this gourmet dinner on Saturday night, which is a catered affair at these beautiful locations that's really normally reserved for like a wedding rehearsal dinner with farm-to-table caterers. So a beautiful feast, and people can meet the farm families participating. The pro riders are there too. Just sort of this great area for people to meet and connect. Most people don't have farmers in their social circle, and so it's a fun way to get these two worlds together.
You're putting the best of all worlds that that bicycle riders want together, because we love to eat, obviously.
Yeah.
Because we ride our bikes a lot, so therefore we want to eat even more.
Food.
And then food, yeah, there you go. And then we love to see these unbelievable views that you have in these rides. You know, you've got these beautiful rural areas, and it's gorgeous. And Fran has done a couple of them.
Yes.
She did a couple of them last year, which thank you very much for. Those were really good. And you had some interesting stops too along the way. There were some very interesting rest stops, and maybe Fran, you might want to jump in on this one and tell us what you saw that was interesting to you.
Oh yeah, so there were different things. There were different kinds of farms, and often the farms would feature something that they grew there. So if they were, for example, a chicken farm, they might have frittat there, and they have frittats for you to eat that were made from their chickens. That sort of thing. One of the most fun times I had at a rest stop was on the Vermont Farm to Fork Fondo, and I think it was the last rep stop, and it was so I did the Grand Fondo, which was like 112 miles, and it included three gaps, and I've never summited a gap in my life.
For you.
And I went
I think
up,
you overwhelmed her.
So we did Brandon App and Baby. Is that the order that they're in?
Yeah.
Brandon App and Baby, or did you Brandon
app,
Baby
app,
and App?
Baby App and yeah.
Yes.
I can't remember exactly how they go. All
my goodness.
I know is that I've raced my bike over those things and it hurts.
And then yeah. Going down the other side, you have to be very careful. You go down Madlet River Glen, you could almost either miss it or crash into it.
No, mindless really abandon down the backside.
Sure.
I keep
okay.
telling you,
very
mindless
good.
Abandon.
So, but that final rest stop, which is that mile 90-something, and the Vermont Farm to Fork Fund was very interesting because it was different than the others. A lot of the others were there was a lot of climbing and not a lot of flat. You were going up and down and up and down. But Vermont was very interesting because you would basically summit a gap and then there'd be these long areas of relatively flat to rolling terrain. So it was really neat. This last one was in this last area. After you summited the last gap, I guess it was Baby, you're done with Mad River Glen, you're done with App Gap and all. And so this lovely farm, they were a berry farm, and you could see people picking raspberries in the field. And this woman ran up to me from the field. I think it was one of the owners of the farm. She ran up to me and said, "Here, I just picked these. Eat them." I'm like, okay. So I ate the berries that she handed me, which is very nice. And then I went to the table. They were really nice to me. They were really happy to see me. And they had some jam that they had made from those fresh berries, some nice raspberry stuff. And then they had honey, two kinds of local raw honey that somebody had. I don't know if they had bees there or someone else did, but these two huge vats of this local honey. And here I am at mile 92 of a ride. And honey, as you know, can be a wonderful, performance food that you take that in place of your sport gels. You can put honey in your sport. So here they had raw local honey, okay? And they had two kinds. One was more savory and one was more sweet. And it was fantastic. And I don't eat gluten, so I couldn't eat the bread. So they're like, "That's okay. Here's a spoon." And they gave me spoons. I'm spooning out this local honey. And, the sun was shining. It was a beautiful day. They're feeding me honey and berries. And they were super nice to me. And whoa.
That's great.
A cyclist high.
Well, and the other thing about Vermont was maple. They had maple water at most of the rest stops, and places had maple syrup, and they had maple maple sport gels that were not really sport gels. They were just maple syrup in packs. And so they were all about the maple syrup is another thing you can use as a sport food. So just beautiful scenic vistas is really something. Anyway.
That's great. And that farmer there at the berry farm, that's actually Sunshine Valley Berry Farm in Rochester,
right.
And Patricia was the farmer. And, the thing is, a lot of these farmers, they never really get recognized. They're working so hard, working 15-hour days in the summertime on these farms and selling their berries wholesale. Maybe they have a farmer's market, and they kind of toil in anonymity a little bit. So I think they get really excited when we recognize them and thank them for their contributions and bring people to their farm to see what they're passionate about. And they love their berries. And they love when people taste their honey and get excited about their honey because they want it. So such a great thing. Great to hear your experience. Thanks for sharing.
That honey got me the rest of the way home.
Yeah, and Fran has been known to show a level of excitement at times. If you hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
So there's something else that goes along with your fondos, too, that I recognized from last year, and that is that you're also doing some charity work, right? Some fundraising for certain groups?
We do, yeah. We have this thing called the Volunteer Competition. So any local farm organization, any local farm, or even any local community group can participate. We raise money to put into a pot that we donate to groups that volunteer at the event. So, and the thing is, all of those volunteers get organized into these color-coded teams. They each have different color T-shirts that represent the local organization. So the participants vote for their favorite volunteer team at the end of the ride, and that determines the size of the cash donation we give. So it's not a cutthroat competition. Everyone gets a donation, but it's a way to make it really fun for the volunteers. They dress up in costumes, they make signs to try to get the riders to vote for their team, and it's a great way to interact with these local groups that are doing great work in the area and to support them. So we try really hard to make these events as fun for the volunteers as it is for the participants, too.
Well, it certainly seems that way. Everyone seems to be having a good time. The other thing that I got to tell you, was it in the main one? Yeah, it was the main one that you did, the last one you did last year. The band was great at the end. They were fun. I really had a good time with them. You have entertainment for people when they get done. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, we just try to highlight as much about the local area as we can. You know, it's not only the farmers, but also like the small community groups and the you know, we have a local festival market where we invite local vendors and craft people to sell and exhibit their wares and the local music. I spend a lot of time, I make relationships in all these venues to try to bring about the, you know, something that really features the local area. And it's not just me. I have a team that's also making these relationships, and it just, there, each one of these spots, there's just so much special stuff going on, and the local VOR scene is more than just the farming. It's about the communities too, and I'm really excited to highlight them.
That's great. So when did you actually start doing this?
So 2014, that last year I was racing professionally, I actually had a great relationship with my team, and I said, hey, you know, maybe this last year if I can race on the team but have like a limited schedule, less responsibility, less pay, and help me make this transition. So I organized an event that September, the first year, my last year racing professional, and that was the first event that I organized in upstate New York. And then the following year, that was sort of pilot events and just sort of trying to play with these ideas and get this off the ground. And then the following year is when I founded the Farm to Fork Fonda series, so 2015. So we're entering our third year here.
Okay, so the first year you just had one event. The second year you had four events?
Two events.
Okay. And then the third year is when you moved it up to four events, correct?
Right. Last year we had four, and then this year we have six.
Six events. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
It's great. It's really good. Yeah. And of course, you probably get a lot of people that will do one of the events and then want to come back and do another one because they'll want to see a different area or whatever. And that's so it almost advertises itself in that way. It's kind of cool.
Absolutely. You know, we have some diehards that are, you know, we had one person who signed up on the first day for all six events this year, and she's from the Virgin Islands.
So from the Virgin Islands?
If anyone's going to get the Farm to Fort Fondo tattoo, I think she might be the first one to get it.
I think so. That makes a lot of sense. So what have you added on the, well, let's go over where they are first. We'll go right down the list. Your first one is at?
So Hudson Valley in early June.
Mm-hmm.
And then Finger Lakes is a brand new event this year. That's in later June. Wine Country in upstate New York.
Nice.
Then we have Vermont that Brand mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Pennsylvania Dutch down in the Amish country in Pennsylvania, stopping at authentic Amish farms.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the main event with the post-ride lobster bake. Our venue is a farm right in the ocean. And then the last event this year is also a brand new event, which is the Berkshires in Western Mass, really like the epicenter of the farm table movement in Massachusetts.
Oh, boy, the Berkshires. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some good climbs there.
Yeah, there are a few good climbs, but there's also just some awesome farms and beautiful roads.
Oh, it's gorgeous out there. That whole Route 7 corridor that goes down through the Berkshires is just beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. So that's great. So we've got a lot of events to look forward to this year, which is wonderful. That's good to see. So if anyone is interested in this, I'm just going to read this off for them. If anyone's listening and they want to know how to find out more, you have a website, which is www.renegadesports.com, and that's WRENEGADES sports.com. So, because it's your last name is Ren with a W, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and I would actually encourage them to visit farmtoforkfondo.com to learn about the events as well.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Very good. Very good. So my guest today has been Tyler Wren from Renegade Sports and also former professional bicycle racer. Very exciting with some cool stories. We can, I got a little bit more time here. I'm going to back you up to the whole bicycle racing thing. What was the craziest day you had on your bicycle as a professional bicycle racer?
Wow, I had a lot of crazy days.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure.
The one thing I remember is this race in Mexico that we did, the Tour of Mexico. And the thing about racing down in South America is they have a lot of crazy traffic furniture, is what they call it.
Not good.
Sort of botch dots that are the size of soccer balls and speed bumps on crazy downhills. So everyone down there is sort of used to it, and they even have a special way of pointing out speed bumps when you are going so fast that you don't want to take your hands off the handlebars. They sort of wave their legs and their arms like a chicken.
Oh, that's funny.
So
you know what's coming up.
because you're going so fast that they don't want to take, and it's so sketchy that they don't want to take their hands off the bars.
Understandable.
Like you normally just point to it.
Sure.
So there was one stage down there where it was just repeatedly going up and down, and these descents were becoming more and more narrow and more speed bumps and bus stops, and I was just like, in our litigious society in the United States, no one would ever allow a race on these roads. And I was going back to our team car to get a bottle. We have the vehicles following the race to support the riders. So if you need a water bottle, you typically drop back off the group and put your hand up, and your vehicle will come up to you and give you a water bottle. So I was doing that, and the course took a turn and went down the hill, and going like 40, 50 miles an hour, and normally that's not a big deal. You can still communicate with your car and get a water bottle. But speed bumps started coming up, and the car hit this speed bump and caught air next to me. And I was on my bike, and I was trying to hang on hitting those speed bumps myself, and I was like, okay, this is just crazy. And it's just par for the course down there, but it's kind of like the Wild West when you race down there. But that day in particular just got me alarmed, and I think pro cyclists have this huge sense of risk, because we're doing stuff like that all the time. But that was the one day that actually put my alarm bells on. Like, wow, this is actually really risky behavior, and maybe I should just take it easy.
Yeah, I hear you. I was in a big race down in Delaware that it worked its way down the coast, and it was just an enormous field. And there were just – we went through the like train tracks of kind of that, I don't know what it was, the freight section of Wilmington, Delaware. And they were just, you make a right, you go over train tracks, you make another left, you go over more train tracks, back and forth. And people were just ejecting from their bicycles. And you get done with the race. It was a 90-mile road race the first day, followed by a crit down at Rehoboth Beach the next day. And, I remember spending that evening walking down the beach going, why am I doing this? Because, you just saw so many people that got hurt, and you kind of wonder sometimes why you're doing it. But, I know why you do it. You do it because there's just a rush to the whole bike thing, the whole bike racing thing. There's nothing like it. I can't explain it. I really can't explain it. All I can say is it was the most fun I ever had. And, it's obviously you got to experience things at a much higher level, and this was really great. It was great talking to you today, Tyler. I'm looking forward to talking to you again soon, and seeing you at Farm to Forks. And remember, this is, if you want to know more about the Farm to Fork Fondo, you can go directly to www.farmforkfondo.com. And you can learn all about the events that are coming up this year. Pick one. Go have fun. Go ride your bike. It's a great time. Thank you, Tyler, for being on the air today. We really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun, and we'll do it again soon. So
great.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for having me, Ron and Fran. You guys put on a great show, so I appreciate being on.
Go Tigers.
Go Tigers? Oh, Princeton.
<There we go>.
Right. All right. Take care.
Okay, all the best, guys.
All right.
Thank you.
So, anyway, moving on. That was just a great interview. Again, that was Tyler Wren, who is a former professional bicycle racer who has taken his passion and experience with riding a bicycle and racing a bicycle and moved it on to the next level, giving back to his community. And you've heard me rant here before on Bicycle Talk about, you know, giving back to your sport. Well, Tyler has taken it to a whole new level, and he puts on great events. So you certainly, if you get a chance to do one of these, you really would like, you really should, you know, come on out. If you're listening on a podcast, then certainly come visit us. Come visit the northeastern part of the United States, and I guarantee you a very, very good time. On the, let's see, what do we have here? On the calendar, Nairo Quintana has just wrapped up his second overall victory at the Tirreno Adriatico, so that is over with right now. And coming up in a couple of days on March 18th, one of the classics of all the classics, the Milan-San Remo, is coming up. And that's a big event in the world of bicycle racing, if you're into that. The Milan-San Remo has been around for more than a century. And so it's just grueling races in northwestern Italy. It's early. It's pre-Giro time. It's time to get excited. Here come the big classic races, and they're just stacking up right now. So really good time. Keep your eyes on that. If you want more information on that, I'll try to post it on the Facebook site so you can have links to it and check it out and see. My name is Pedalin' Ron. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. You can send us an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. And remember, you can hear the podcast of this show and others on whus.org. You can also find us on iTunes. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, Connecticut.